enmeshed, entangled, you can still get out unless, poor fool, you stand in your own way. A quote by Lucretius. It's a trap. A quote by Admiral Akbar from Return of the Jedi. Let's wrap up this series on self-deception by completing our list of self-deception mechanisms. I promised you a list of over 60 of them. We're going to cover about 30 of them here today, picking right back up from where we left off with part two. So, I got a really big one for you to begin with, which is ignoring one's own conflicts of interest. Oh man, talk about a self-deception mechanism. This one is huge. And under it, this is such a big one that there are some subtopics, which I include double standards as another self-deception sub-mechanism here, self-justifications and excuse-making, backwards rationalization, confabulation, and wanting or needing a thing to be true. So let's talk about all of these, but let's begin with this central point about conflict of interest. What is a conflict of interest, and why is it so deceptive? Well, think about a tobacco company executive who has built his entire career on climbing the corporate ladder for 20 years, and now he's the CEO of this tobacco company. And let's imagine this was before there was a lot of good scientific evidence which conclusively proved that tobacco caused cancer. So back then, in his own mind, it was iffy. You know, he might have suspected that cigarettes aren't really the healthiest thing, but it wasn't conclusive. But then what starts to happen is as he's CEO, all this evidence and all this science starts coming out. But of course, this presents a huge conflict of interest because his entire career and his entire identity and the way he feeds himself and his family, the way he puts his kids through college, depends on him being this great executive of this successful tobacco company. So is he going to really listen to that scientific evidence when it comes out? Is he going to be objective? Very, very unlikely. And of course, we understand how this works in these sorts of situations. We understand when politicians act with conflict of interest. We even have laws against conflict of interest where judges or attorneys or certain heads of government are supposed to recuse themselves in a situation where they have a conflict of interest, because a judge can't judge a situation when his own interests are involved, like financially, for example. But this is a much bigger thing than just politicians and judges and CEOs. This goes to all of us. And it especially applies very strongly in areas of how we make our living. Although, of course, there can be other kinds of conflict of interest, but especially where you make your living. Because it's precisely the place that you get your livelihood from that you are most likely not to question if there's something there which isn't completely true or authentic. And so a lot of people build their entire careers on inauthenticity and falsehood and unconsciousness. And even though in the back of their mind they know this, they can't really ever admit it to themselves because, hey, how am I going to survive? You see, the reason it's so closely tied to someone's career is because career isn't just about going to work. It's actually your survival. It's how you bring home the paycheck. And in modern society, bringing home the paycheck is equivalent to an animal hunting for food. It's sort of like you're taking away the lion's ability to hunt for antelope. Of course, the lion is not going to stand for that because his very survival is on the line. So this becomes a very potent self-deception mechanism. And of course, I don't exclude myself from this. And in fact, actualize.org is a significant conflict of interest for me as I pursue the truth and as I do spirituality, because, hey, you know, when you start to get successful, you start to develop a reputation, you start to release courses and you start to earn money for what you're doing the way that I do, then sure, yeah, there's a pressure. There's a pressure like you need and you want things to come out a certain way because that helps your business, for example. What if the truth happens to not help your business? What if it actually starts to erode your business? What are you going to do? Are you going to side with the truth or with your business, with your success, with your career? So that's tricky. That's something I've had to navigate for a few years now. And I still have to navigate that. I have to walk that path very carefully. And that's always been a challenge for mixing spirituality with money. That's why a lot of people don't like to do that. And a lot of teachers will say, oh, you shouldn't charge money for teaching at all. Because if it's a true teaching, then it should be free. And generally, I'm on board. That's why most of my videos are free, just a little bit of ads. But of course, there's also the reality that you need money and you need energy in order to fuel something. So if someone's doing this full time, putting a lot of their time and energy into it, then it also becomes a way of making a living. So it's tricky. It's tricky to navigate that. There's no like clear and cut answers for how to do it. So the next subpoint is double standards. And this one I find really interesting to observe in politics, for example, where it's very crystal clear. And the hypocrisy there is incredible. It's just stunning how much double standards exist within politics. For example, we're seeing it nowadays with Republicans and with Democrats. And there's a double standard on both sides. So one of the double standards with Republicans and conservatives is that when one of their politicians gets accused of lying or immorality or some sexual scandal or something like that, which traditionally, you know, they like to be the party of morality, then, of course, they ignore it. And they don't really take it seriously because they have a double standard. They expect morality from everybody else, but really from themselves. But then, of course, you got the same sort of problem happening with liberals and with the Democrats, because nowadays, with all the sexual scandals coming out, Democrats want to take like a firm stance on sexual abuse. But then, of course, the Democrats have a lot of instances of sexual abuse in their past with their politicians, especially Bill Clinton, for example. And so, you know, where were the Democrats and where was their outrage about sexual scandals and sexual abuse back in the Clinton era? So see, of course, they turn a blind eye to it because it's all about how your mind is able to push through its self-agenda. So really, the thing, if you're part of a political party, that you care about is that your political party is winning. That's the same thing as your ego winning. So of course, you're going to use and manipulate whatever evidence or facts come your way for your own benefit. And you're going to ignore and cherry pick all the stuff that doesn't serve your agenda. And that's why you see so much hypocrisy within politics. And a lot of people are disillusioned by that, of course. But that doesn't just happen in politics. That happens within yourself as well. You should start to notice double standards that you hold in many areas within your life. Scientists hold a lot of double standards. You might think scientists are supposed to be the objective ones, but of course, that's not quite true, right? Because you might take a hard-nosed scientist, like a physicist or something, and you might start talking to him about some religious topic or some spiritual topic, and he'll say, oh, but there's no objective proof for God or for any of this religious stuff, so I can't take any of it seriously. Right? So that's one standard, but is he applying that same standard to himself and to science? Is there objective proof, for example, that there exists an external world? Of course not. There never was, and there never will be. Because the objective the external world, this is a conceptual construction. And there can be no proof for it. And of course, science has never proved it. But do most scientists accept this? Do most scientists really question the existence of the external world? No, not at all. Because that just comes to them as part of the dogma of the scientific paradigm. So of course, how do they get away with it? By having a double standard. So people who are very rational and skeptically minded, they often have a very strong, harsh standard that they apply to spiritually minded people and New Age people. And they like to criticize and dismiss the New Age people because, oh, the New Age people, they have such lax standards of evidence and criteria. They're not really hard-nosed enough. but what about the scientists? What about the rationalists? What about the materialists? Do you actually have conclusive proof that the universe is rational? That it's material? See? Do you have conclusive proof that there exists a self? Why do you believe in a self? Have scientists ever proven the existence of a self? No, of course not. All this stuff is just taken for granted. And then a double standard is applied to a bunch of other religious stuff. Which, of course, is a gross hypocrisy. But the mind doesn't see it. Precisely because it sets up these standards and it doesn't know that it's setting up these standards. To the mind, it seems like, no, this is just reality, this is just truth. And we see a lot of double standards, very interestingly, within spiritual traditions and communities. So, for example, you might go to the Buddhists as one community, or you might go to the Neo-Advaitins as another community. And you ask them, okay, so if I use your spiritual techniques or your meditation technique or your self-inquiry technique, so is this going to like produce all the results for me? Is this going to make me enlightened or awaken me or whatever and grow me? And of course, the Buddhists will say, yes, of course, our techniques are the best. And then you ask the Neo-Advaitins, what about your techniques? Are they the best? And they say, yeah, of course, our techniques are the best. The Buddhist techniques, they're not so good. See? And every group you notice does this. And then if I ask the Buddhist group, okay, so how good are your techniques really, objectively? Like, what if we compare them with the Neo-Advaitin techniques? And what are the Buddhists going to say? The Buddhists are going to say, oh, those Neo-Advaitin techniques, they don't really enlighten people. They produce half-baked enlightenments, and they're not really as good and strong as our techniques. But when you actually take a look at any school and you objectively evaluate how good their techniques are, in truth, what you discover is that 98% of all spiritual techniques are utter failures. And all the students who go to all the workshops and all the seminars and all the Vipassana retreats and all the satsangs and all of that, do they ever become awakened? Do they ever radically transform their consciousness? No, of course not. Because that's true across the board, across all spiritual traditions, across all spiritual techniques. So the trick, though, of belonging to one school is to turn a blind eye to all the people who fail using your own techniques. So what the Buddhists will do is they'll say, ah, Leo, but look at all these people who have become enlightened through Buddhist teachings and techniques. Yes, of course. But you're ignoring the even greater number who never did and never will. And so the Buddhists will point to the Neo-Advaitins and they'll say, oh, look at all the people who fail at Neo-Advaita. Yes, of course. But look at all the people who also fail at Buddhism. Just as many, if not more. And of course, that's true of Neo-Advaita and of a very other tradition, basically. It's really quite amazing at the double standards that these schools have. And why is that? Because the loyalty of the person who belongs to one of these traditions or schools is, of course, the school comes first. That's like the new ego that's being defended. And so there's no objective analysis that's actually happening or objective comparison of which techniques are actually the best, objectively speaking. That's never actually done. These people don't go out and they don't try 20 different techniques. They try a couple of techniques within their tradition, and then they become staunch defenders of that. Self-justification and excuse-making, of course, serves to enforce these double standards. So these double standards are never acknowledged to be double standards. They're always excused away. The mind always comes up with a good excuse for why there should be an exception for Buddhism or for Neo-Advaita or for something else. So, of course, it'll cherry-pick evidence to make its case. And also, it'll employ the tools of backwards rationalization and confabulation. And this is a really powerful phenomenon. Psychologists have called it confabulation. It's when actually they've pinpointed it to the left hemisphere in the human brain. There are modules in the left hemisphere which are extremely good at backwards rationalizing or confabulating a story which explains a situation after the fact to fit a particular narrative or agenda that the person has. And there are some remarkable cases with with people who have brain disorders, which very clearly illustrate just how strong confabulation can be. And I'll actually shoot an episode that I plan in the future about brain disorders and all the interesting stuff that goes on with those. And there I will talk about some amazing cases of confabulation, which will utterly blow your mind. People who backwards rationalize the most incredibly false things and trick themselves into believing that it's actually true, because they fail to take into account that when the mind is rationalizing, it can rationalize almost anything it wants. In the same way that an attorney, a really good attorney, can argue for almost any case. And a good attorney can stand there in a courtroom with a big smile on his face and legitimately defend a rapist or a murderer or some corrupt politician. How does he do that? Precisely because he's using his left hemisphere to do this sort of confabulating, building a strong case through cherry-picking of evidence and having these double standards. And the last subcomponent here is wanting or needing a thing to be true. For whatever reason, maybe you need a thing to be true because your relationship hinges on it, or you having sex hinges on it, or you not upsetting your child hinges on it. So what you're going to do in that case is, because you don't want to upset your child, or because you want to have sex, or because you want to maintain your relationship, or because you want to keep your career, you are going to say, to hell with the truth. Of course, this is all done subconsciously, so you don't consciously say, to hell with the truth. But subconsciously, you say, to hell with the truth, I'm going to go with what's going to serve me the most. And so you do. And so then that's how these self-deceptions get enforced. The next self-deception mechanism is unwillingness to do personal investigation into matters. Not being willing to actually put in the time and energy to do research. This is a big trap that I see people falling into. Because I might present some technique or some abstract philosophical idea, for example, through my content, and then some skeptic will post to me and say, oh, Leo, but where's the proof for that? Well, the proof is you going and actually doing the research. But then, of course, they say, ah, but Leo, why should I do the research? Give me the proof for why the research will be useful for me to do. But you see, that's, of course, sort of a catch-22. If you're looking for proof for why the research is going to be valuable, then you're not really serious about doing the research. To be a really good researcher, what you need to understand is that research could lead to a dead end, and that not every single path that you pursue within a research project is necessarily going to lead to gold. And in fact, most companies who do research, like pharmaceutical companies or technology companies, military research, all this sort of stuff, what happens with their research projects? Most of them end up going nowhere. Most technologies never come to market. Most new drugs that are being tested will fail the approval process. And you might say, oh, that's a huge waste of money. Yes, but the whole value of research is that you take multiple paths, you pursue multiple avenues, and then you have a shot at discovering something big, striking gold. But you can't do that so long as from the very beginning, you need to be guaranteed of the result. You see, and it's the same way with personal development research. I research a lot of stuff and not all of it pans out. I try and dabble with different techniques, and not all of those techniques work for me or produce the kind of results that I want. But then once in a while, I strike on a technique that's really amazing and really powerful. And I would never have been able to stumble upon it had I not had this mindset of being a researcher and being willing to try stuff and having it fail. But see, to be a good researcher, that requires that you don't judge things too harshly from the outset. You need to be open to the fact that your mind can be changed. That's why you're doing research. You would be a very bad researcher if you assumed the result, the end result of your research before you actually did the research. If that was the case, you wouldn't need to do research to begin with because you'd already know what's true and what's the best. But the whole point is that you don't know what's the best and what's true. Therefore, you need to keep your mind open. It would be sort of like, imagine that you're fat and you've never been to the gym. And then I tell you, hey, you know, you can get really buff. You can get like one of those weightlifter bodies by going to the gym and doing squats and doing the treadmill and all this sort of stuff. But you're very skeptically minded. So you say, ah, Leo, but where's the proof? Show me the proof. And I say, well, the proof is in the doing. Go to the gym, do it, and get your results. But you're so skeptical that, of course, what do you say? You say, oh, Leo, but okay, fine. You convinced me. You've convinced me. I'm open-minded. I'm going to go for 1 week and I'm going to try it. And then I'll prove you either right or wrong. So you go for a week, you try it, and then you say, aha, Leo, look, I went for a week, I tried it, and look, I proved you wrong, I'm still fat, I'm still not the weightlifter that, I don't have that weightlifter body that you promised me. Yes, of course, because you're still fundamentally closed-minded. See, what's required for this case to succeed is you have to be much more open-minded than you are. You have to try it for a whole year, maybe for 2 years, and you have to be serious about it. You can't half-ass it. It's the same thing with personal development techniques and with spiritual techniques. You can't just go meditate for a week, half-assing it, and then say, okay, if I don't get my results, then I'm quitting. Well, if that's your attitude, you might as well not go do it at all. You're just wasting your week there. It's not enough to be 5% open-minded, as in these failed cases. You need to be 100% open-minded so that the situation could actually work on you and transform you. But see, the self-deception that a lot of people get themselves into is with this sort of false sense of open-mindedness. They're unwilling to actually do personal investigation into existential matters or into personal development or into spirituality or any of this kind of stuff. And then they complain that, oh, there's not enough evidence. There's not enough evidence, Leo, about self-help. Only because you haven't bothered to get off your ass and do the personal investigation. And of course not, because you're lazy and because your mind wants to stay stuck in all its old paradigms and all its old habits. To actually do real research, real personal investigation into things, that is emotionally challenging, and it's actually going to transform you, and it's going to kill you in various ways to various degrees. And that's, of course, something the mind doesn't want. The next self-deception mechanism is assuming rigid dualistic categories or distinctions. And this is something that's plagued Western thought for over 2,000 years, ever since Aristotle, who came up with all these categories for reality. And what do I mean by these dualistic categories or distinctions? Well, the mind loves to think of reality as having these fixed categories, like science versus religion, as though these two things are totally separate. And either you're scientific or you're religious. Or how about the category of good and bad? Either something is good or something is bad, or it's evil. Or subjective versus objective. Either something is objective or it's subjective. Or mind versus body. Or physical versus immaterial. Or life versus death. And there's hundreds of others of these dualistic sort of categories. A really good example might be natural versus artificial. This is one that trips a lot of people up. A lot of people will use this argument of like, oh, well, Leo, this thing here is good because it's natural. And that thing there is bad because it's artificial. But what they don't understand is that they're assuming this category is somehow fundamental to reality. But it's really not. This is just a conceptual category. And science has been plagued by this for a very long time. And it still is to this day. Many scientists just assume that these sorts of categories are true of reality, that they are objective. When in fact, the notion of objective is itself one of these categories. The truth is that all such categories ultimately collapse when you explore them broadly and deeply enough. Only when you have a very narrow perspective can one of these categories hold up. You know, in many situations in life, such a category does hold up. Like, you can say that an item or a food is artificial or natural. And loosely speaking, that can be true, and that can be a useful distinction to make. But you always have to keep in mind that there's nothing fundamental about it. And that ultimately, if you explore this question of which foods are natural and artificial, you should understand and you should expect that that's going to collapse and break down. And it's never going to be so simple as just categorizing this piece of fruit or that vegetable or that piece of meat as being artificial or natural. Because there are no sharp boundaries within reality. There's always just these fuzzy edges. And that's what we find with science. You know, as science investigates things deeper and deeper and deeper, they see that all of these sorts of simplistic categories that we used to have, for example, that Aristotle came up with 2,000 years ago, that all of them ultimately collapse, including, for example, the category of matter versus energy, which is something that was discovered by Einstein and by quantum physicists over 100 years ago now, is that there is no such category. Even though, simplistically speaking, yes, we assume that there is a difference between matter and energy. But also now we know that you can convert one into the other. That's what nuclear reactions are about. Or how about with light being a particle or a wave? See, early scientists thought that it must be one or the other, because they assumed that this is a rigid categorization scheme, and that nature must fit into one box or another box. But then they discovered it's not so simple as just light being a particle or a wave. It's got properties of both. Another self-deception mechanism is being overly logical and rational. I've talked about this in the past. Hopefully you can see how this becomes a self-deception mechanism, because logic and rationality is not something you can assume is going to deliver truth to you. Not necessarily. There are a lot of rational and logical people in the world who are deluded. So you got to wonder, what's the difference? What's really running the show? Is logic and rationality maybe a tool of the mind to actually maintain its power? Why is it that that lawyers can use logic and reason to argue for all sorts of silly things? And philosophers have used logic and reason to argue for all sorts of silly things as well. So how can you rely on logic and reason? Is it rational and logical to just take on faith that reality can be fully understood through logic and through reason? Or is that just a dogma? Is that just a personal pet theory of yours that you're clinging to? Another closely associated self-deception mechanism with this one is thinking bias, something I call thinking bias. It's when a person thinks that thinking is the only way that one can understand reality, and that thinking is the best way, and that there is nothing beyond thinking, and that if I can't think it, then it can't be true, or it can't be real, and that anything that is true or is real must be thinkable. But what if there are other ways of interacting and understanding reality other than thought, such as, for example, intuition? Or such as, for example, direct consciousness. See, people who are very logical and rational don't take these other modalities very seriously because they're just stuck on thinking all the time. And the mind, of course, loves to think. So, of course, that's a conflict of interest that it has. Since it loves to think that thinking is the best and that thinking is all that there is. But how do you know that you can trust all the thinking that your mind does? That's the very thing that we're questioning here. So we have to be careful not to use our thinking to justify our thinking, you see, because that just creates a vicious circle. Another related self-deception bias is what I call analysis bias, or self-deception mechanism, rather, is analysis bias. What is this? This is the tendency of rational and scientifically minded people to want to analyze the world to death, thinking that the best way to understand the world and to arrive at truth is through analysis, or a sort of a reductionist philosophy, where we take everything, we just split it apart, slice and dice it, and by doing so, thinking that we're going to get to the most fundamental elements. And of course, this is something we see, for example, within science, within the physical sciences. It's like if you take a cell and you break it apart into its little molecules and stuff, then you get chemicals. And if you break those chemicals apart, then you get atoms. And if you break those apart, you get quarks. And so we say, okay, so if we just study quarks, then we're going to understand everything about reality. But of course, it doesn't work this way. This is another bias that the mind has, which is fragmentation. The mind just assumes that if it can just break everything apart into little pieces, that it'll understand. Because see, the mind can't deal with big stuff. It needs to simplify things down, break it down into little pieces, because it can't hold the whole. But what's interesting about reality is that just taking some pieces and arranging them together doesn't produce the whole. The most interesting phenomenon in life are emergent phenomenon that is greater than the sum of its individual parts. See? You take a bunch of little bouncing around plutonium atoms, and if you have a small number of them, they just bounce around. They vibrate. But you have enough of them, and you trigger them, and then you get a chain reaction, now you get all of a sudden a nuclear weapon. That's very different. That's a huge qualitative shift there when you get past that critical mass. And a lot of other things in life work that way. So fragmentation is a poor way of, generally speaking, understanding reality, especially if you care about the big picture. And this analysis bias, you see it very prevalent throughout our universities and in academia, because there people become hyper-specialized within a subdomain of some science, and they become technical masters of that subdomain, and they learn about some very niche esoteric topic like molecular biology or some subfield within algebra or calculus. And then they think that because they have that, they've understood the world. But of course, they haven't. What they've gotten sucked into is small picture thinking. Really, if you want to have a true understanding of the world, what you're looking for is you're looking for wisdom, and you're looking for big picture thinking, and you're looking for holism, which is actually the opposite of analysis and fragmentation. You're looking for synthesis. You're looking for getting a gestalt of the entire thing, which is difficult for the mind to do. It's difficult for the logical mind to do this. Actually, it can't. This sort of holistic understanding requires more intuitive capacities, which many people are out of touch with. And so this sort of analysis and reductionism ultimately can lead to a lot of self-deception, because it might seem like when you're analyzing everything to death that you're understanding it all, but actually you are just investing a lot of your time and energy understanding the minutiae of life, but missing the most important parts. Which is why you can have a scientist who's a brilliant mathematician or a physicist or something like that, but he's not going to have wisdom. He's not going to have an understanding of what reality is, or what emotions are, or how to be in a relationship. And you might say, oh, well, Leo, but that's not his job. Yeah, exactly. That's the whole problem. See, when you define your job as a very narrow thing, then that's what you become. You become this technician, this little technical robot. And then you're not happy with your life. You're depressed. Your life doesn't go well. Because for your life to go well, you need to be more of a generalist with life rather than a technician. And this is especially a problem in universities, because universities put a lot of pressure on intellectuals to become hyper-technicians. And you would think that, well, in a university, we should have our smartest people in society would be the professors and academics and the doctors and the PhDs. But it actually turns out to be oftentimes quite the opposite. Don't go to a university to find wisdom. That's the irony of it. The next self-deception mechanism is what I call impossibility bias. It's assuming that your intuition of what's possible and impossible is correct. How many times have we seen throughout the history of science or humanity where people have made bold predictions about things that aren't impossible? Powered man flight is impossible. Nuclear explosions are impossible. X is impossible. Y is impossible. This thing is impossible. That thing is impossible. And then what happens is that usually within 100 years, and oftentimes much quicker, these people are proven to be wrong. Why is this? How could they have deceived themselves so? For example, there's a famous example of Lord Kelvin, who is one of the top respected scientists in the late 1800s. And he made a famous pronouncement that powered manned flight will never be possible. It's a scientific impossibility. And that was just 5 years before the Wright brothers created and flew the first plane. So that was rather a huge embarrassment for him. He also famously said that X-rays are a hoax and that they are also impossible. And then he was very quickly proven wrong. So how could this be the case? Well, because the mind gets arrogant and it takes the limits of its imagination for the limits of reality. And we see this time and time again. It's not just with Lord Kelvin. You see this with very many intelligent people throughout Western intellectual tradition. It's quite remarkable how easily they trick themselves. One thing that we have discovered throughout human history is that the future always surprises us in radical ways. And new things end up being possible which we could have never have conceived of. You know, just go back 500 years and tell them that you're going to have a smartphone which has streaming video on it that you can use all over the country without any interruptions in service, and you can talk to your mom across the world. And it all works seamlessly. And they would have called you out as a heretic and as a sorcerer if you said that. Even scientists would say you're deluded because what you're saying is completely unscientific. That's completely impossible. You're talking about some kind of magical wireless technologies, non-physical immaterial technologies, delivering radio waves and all this stuff. This is hocus pocus. That's what they would have told you. Because we mistake our own limited imaginations for the limitations of the world. That's a powerful lesson you can learn from history. Another self-deception mechanism is mistaking truth with provability. Again, many intelligent and rational and scientific people mistake these two things, the notion of truth and provability. These are two different things, and the domain of things which are true is much larger than the domain of things that are provable. Whereas many rationally minded people think that these domains are identical. They think that if a thing is true, it must be provable. And if it's not provable, that means it must not be true. That's actually false. And it's actually been proven. For example, Kurt Gödel actually proved that within mathematics, the domain of truth must always be much larger than the domain of provability. And that was within a hard field like mathematics, not to mention ordinary everyday situations. So a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that, oh, Leo, well, if you're saying something and it's very profound and it's true, that means you should be able to easily prove it to me. No, not at all. In fact, the most profound things are often completely unprovable. because the truth doesn't care about provability. Provability is something that you do in a sort of formal way. Like a self-help technique might be very helpful for you. It might calm your emotions. Certain meditation techniques can get you to all sorts of interesting mystical states and like that, stuff like that. But proving it is much harder. Because proving it is like you have to pay a lot of money to set up a double-blind clinical study in a laboratory. Those usually cost tens of millions of dollars. They usually take up a lot of time. They can take many years to do. They require large sample sizes, a lot of, you know, careful controlling of all the variables. Who's going to pay for that? You think science just goes around and proves everything that's true? No, science cherry picks what it goes after. These experiments are very expensive, so science has to be very selective as to what it's going to fund and what it's going to research. And of course, it mostly does the research on stuff that's going to earn it money, which is how science is biased by business and by marketing. Another related self-deception mechanism is expecting the truth to be thrust upon you and proven to you overwhelmingly against your own resistance. So some skeptics will take this position of like, oh, Leo, well, if what you're talking about is true, then you should be able to prove it beyond a doubt, such that I am convinced no matter how much of a devil's advocate and a skeptic that I play. No, of course not. In fact, the truth is such a delicate thing that if you are not willing to surrender yourself to it completely, then you're never going to see it. This is a big mistake that people make. People assume that the truth is just so overwhelming that it'll convince and persuade anybody. No, it's just the opposite of that. It will only convince the person who is willing to surrender to it. Which means that you have to be willing to meet the truth halfway. You can't sit in your little corner with your ears and eyes shut and expecting me or somebody else to deliver the truth to you. It just doesn't work that way. Another self-deception mechanism is assuming that reality is simple, intuitive, and obvious. And because it is so, we can use linear Aristotelian logic to understand reality. And this linear Aristotelian logic is sort of like a thing is either A or it's B, or it's C or it's D, but it can't be a combination of all the above. Or it can't be that A is part true and part false, and B is part true and part false. See, linear Aristotelian logic says that, no, it must be either A is true or B is true. And most things in the world aren't that simple, aren't that black and white. Which leads me to the self-deception mechanism of black and white thinking. This is something that's very tricky and produces a lot of self-delusion. For example, well, here's a good example for you with personal development, is that people do personal development, but then they hear about enlightenment, and then say, well, Leo, what's the point of personal development? Doesn't enlightenment mean that all personal development is false, and that it's all useless? And see, what that is that's black and white thinking. No, it's not like that. Why would it be that way? Why do you assume that? Why do you need things to be so black and white? Why can't it be the case that you can pursue enlightenment, and even after you get enlightenment, that there's still value to doing personal development, that there are personal development techniques that are just independent of enlightenment that can still improve your life and that you probably want to learn. For example, just because you're enlightened doesn't mean that you understand nutrition and how to feed yourself properly. Or just because you're enlightened doesn't mean that now your relationships are going to be smooth, because you haven't learned how to relate to human beings. And that's a separate issue. But of course, see, people don't like that sort of complexity. And they don't like the complexity of like, well, just because you're enlightened, they think that, oh, now all of a sudden life purpose is pointless. And it's stupid. No, because after enlightenment, you're still going to have to feed yourself. You're still going to have a job, unless you're already a millionaire. So what's your job going to be? Is it going to be working at McDonald's? Are you going to be happy with that? Or would you rather create the kind of job where you're actually doing something that you find meaningful, something that you can be passionate about? See, these things aren't at odds with each other the way that people like to think sometimes. Another example of black and white thinking is some people hear this topic about self-deception and they say, oh, Leo, so that means everything is a self-deception. See, they become indiscriminate. Whereas before they heard about self-deception, they thought nothing was a self-deception. Now they hear me talking about all this self-deception and say, oh, okay, so let's swing the pendulum completely the opposite way. Now everybody is deluded. Every emotion that I have, every thought that I have, everything that's going on with me is complete self-deception. And what does that turn out to be? But just more self-deception. No, the whole point is that self-deception is subtle. It's not black and white. It's not the case that everything is self-deception. You do have genuine motivations and desires within you, and you have certain values that you shouldn't just throw out because you assume that they're lies. You have to actually carefully introspect and look in there and learn how to distinguish between what's true and what's false within you. Otherwise, you're just going to get yourself stuck. Because once you start to think that everything is a self-deception, including your self-deception is self-deception, including everything I'm telling you is a self-deception, including all enlightenment teachings are self-deceptions, so you're so wrapped up in this idea of self-deception that now you've deceived yourself into complete inaction. So now what you do is you do nothing. And what you get is you get the exact same life that you've always gotten, which is largely one based on self-deception. And that just continues and perpetuates, which is the opposite of what we want. What we want here is we want to help you to jailbreak your mind. And that requires nuance, not black and white thinking. How about the next self-deception mechanism? I call it paradox bias. This is a general bias that I notice that most rational minds have and have had throughout Western intellectual tradition since the very beginning of avoiding paradox and avoiding weirdness. They're scared of the paradoxical or weird or strange facets of reality. It's like the human mind, the rational mind, wants reality to also fit its sort of rational agenda. So it tends to only look at phenomena which fit that, and it tends to not look at the paradoxical edge cases. And actually, I find the paradoxical edge cases to be the most interesting aspects of phenomena to study. It's in those gaps or in those cracks that you find the paradoxes from which you can learn the most about the ultimate nature of reality. Because sure, it's easy to look at reality and to cherry pick the phenomena such that it fits your rationalist paradigm. But that's not the whole picture. That's a partial picture. That's a partial picture that fits your rationalist paradigm. And I'll actually shoot an episode in the future where I will present evidence for how many great Western intellectuals have actually been scared to death of paradox and have gone to great lengths to eliminate all traces of paradox from fields like logic, mathematics, and the hard sciences, and how that ultimately got them into trouble and into epistemic blunders. So that's for our future topic. The next self-deception mechanism is taking hard-won knowledge as obvious. A good example of this is, for example, we just assume these days that it's obvious that a surgeon should wash his hands before doing surgery, especially after he's just finished operating on another patient. You'd think, what could be more obvious than that? And yet, 300 years ago, if you proposed the idea that surgeons had to wash their hands in between surgeries, they would have laughed at you. They would have criticized you for daring to say that they're unclean doctors, and they would have actually kicked you out of the hospital. which is actually exactly what happened with the very first doctor who started to propose the idea that washing hands is important for sanitation, and that actually a lot of deaths were caused by not washing hands. Do you think that his ideas were accepted by doctors? No, of course not. They were totally rejected. Because this is not an obvious thing, the way that we assume. And this is just one example of a ton of other pieces of knowledge like this, which to us these days in the 21st century seems totally obvious, but actually many people had to die and overcome a lot of dogma and resistance hundreds of years ago for us now to be able to take this hard-won knowledge as obvious. Now it appears that it never had to be hard-won. No one had to actually fight for it, when in fact, people died for this knowledge. And we are just like standing on the shoulders of giants these days and taking a lot of it for granted. And the reason that this produces a self-deception is because this also gets people to think about the wrong way about how our knowledge will progress. Because if we had to fight so hard to get most of our knowledge nowadays, you have to assume that we're going to also have to fight that hard to keep advancing our knowledge into the future. People just tend to assume that knowledge just comes easily because the truth just reveals itself and everybody agrees to it. No, that's not how knowledge works. The way knowledge works is you constantly have to fight and push and battle against all sorts of self-interest and entrenched interests and dogmas and people's prejudices. So that later, after all that fighting is over, people can say, oh, of course, that's so obvious. We knew it already. Everybody knew that. No, they didn't. They only say that after the victory has been won. Another self-deception mechanism is what I call mindfuck bias. It's the tendency of very intelligent and rational people to look at a trend and expect the trend to just keep going in the same direction. They can just extrapolate it out. And they assume that there's not going to be a surprise reversal somewhere in that trend. And what this does, this sets them up for a mindfuck. And the reason I call it mindfuck bias is fundamentally, these people underestimate the possibility of mindfucks within whatever thing they're studying. Because they think that, oh, you know, if a trend is just going this way, it'll just keep going this way. Like, if population is just rising, it's just going to continue to rise. If computer processing power is growing every year, it's just going to continue to grow. No, not necessarily. You always have to be open for a mindfuck, for a surprise reversal, because reality is nonlinear. Another self-deception mechanism is what I call pragmatic bias. That's the tendency of people to only care about things which they see as obviously useful to them. And then what they say is, they say, well, Leo, if it's not useful, then who cares? Why should I care about it? And this becomes a great source of self-deception. Because, of course, the stuff that's useful to you is the stuff that directly serves your ego, serves your survival. But what if there are things out there that aren't immediately useful or aren't useful at all, but nevertheless are true? You would miss out on those things because you're always so pragmatic that you're only looking for the stuff that's going to immediately help you to advance yourself. You see, but what if life is more than just about advancing yourself? What if life is more than just success or technology? A lot of people these days confuse success and technology with truth. But these are actually poor indicators of truth. Just because something is successful doesn't make it true. In fact, often it's just the opposite. Some of the most successful people are complete frauds. And just because a technology works doesn't mean that it's based on knowledge, which is necessarily true. For example, we have a lot of technology that we've built based on Newtonian mechanics. But we know that Newtonian mechanics is technically false. But it's still very useful. It's a useful approximation. It's not the truth. A lot of rationally minded people place their faith into technology, and they think that, oh, technology will deliver us from all the problems of society. And if we can just get more success, that will, Leo, that will obviate the need for truth. Who cares about truth? And we can just become so rich if our economy can just keep growing and our technology can just keep it increasing, then truth doesn't matter anymore. But what they're doing there is they're overlooking the subtle value of pure truth, of truth for truth's sake. And it's tough. It's really difficult to take a person who's pragmatic and to convince him that, hey, you know, why don't you lay your pragmatism aside and maybe you can just pursue truth for truth's sake for a while and see what that does for you and see how that might surprise you. Because a pragmatical person will say, but Leo, what's in it for me? Is it going to make me richer? Is it going to make my ability to make new technology better? No, maybe it won't. But maybe what it will do is it'll get you to see a bigger picture. Maybe it'll get you to see that life is more than just about pursuing value and just being a pragmatic robot. Which is the whole problem with pragmatism, is that you just become a robot, always just chasing success. That's the problem with value scanning everything all the time. You're putting a value on everything, but then you don't appreciate really anything because you look at a beautiful sunset and I tell you, hey, look at this beautiful sunset. Look at this beautiful painting. And you say, oh, but what's the value of it? How much is that sunset really worth? What's the dollar sign on it? What's that painting really worth? Oh, it's worth $100 million because it's a Van Gogh. Oh yeah, that's interesting. I can appreciate that. But of course there, you're not really appreciating the painting itself. You're appreciating the dollar sign behind it. Because you treat everything as a tool for advancing your personal agenda. But then that backfires on you. Because when you're living your life pragmatically all the time, you're actually missing out on the most fundamental aspect of life, which is the appreciation of the inherent beauty of everything, of being. You're missing out on the beauty of being when you're being pragmatic. Because you're just using the being as a tool towards something else, and something else, and something else. And so it just becomes a never-ending rat race. And you're never fulfilled by that. And then you don't know why. Because you're too pragmatic. That's why. Another deception mechanism is underestimating the influence of business, marketing, and culture in influencing your worldviews and your beliefs and your desires. This is huge. I've talked about it before. I'll just mention it briefly here, but people just don't understand that modern business and marketing literally manufactures our culture. The kind of music that you like, the kind of movies you like, the kind of jokes you like, all of this has been completely influenced by business and by marketing. And this leads to great self-deception because you're just buying into the culture which has been shaped by these companies, but then this culture is designed by these companies so that you do what? So that you buy and do business with them. And so then your life becomes about doing business with them. And you don't even know that that's what your life has become about, because a lot of this stuff happens on sort of a subconscious level and people don't realize it. People are playing video games and watching movies and all this and they think, oh, it's just good fun. Yeah, it's just good fun on one level, but on another level, it's just them milking you for money. And then what kind of information and what kind of values are these movies and these video games and so forth instilling in you? Are they instilling values that are going to actually make you appreciate life more, or values that are going to make you addicted and coming back for more to buy more from those companies? Skewing your entire worldview. See, it's not just like, oh yeah, they're selling me a movie. No, they're skewing your entire worldview in a very subtle but also significant way, such that you're addicted to it and that you actually come to it for all your satisfaction in life. But fundamentally, it's hollow. It's sort of like they're selling you sugar. You consume this sugar, but then you're ultimately unsatisfied on the inside. And your whole picture of reality is wrong as well. That's the sort of the hidden cost that they don't tell you about. The next self-deception mechanism is authority and credentials. This one is big. A lot of people just trust in authority, and they just leave questions about reality up to the experts. They leave it to the academics, to the doctors, to the scientists, to the gurus, as though they have the answers and they will figure it out for us, and we'll just listen to them and we'll just take on whatever they tell us. This happens both with religious people. It's a problem because religious people believe in all sorts of gurus and authorities from the Bible or from some other group. It also happens with science just as much. You think science isn't built upon authority and credentials? It totally is. It's all about what kind of position the scientist has in the university, how many peer-reviewed research papers does he have, how many citations does he have, how many books has he written, have those books been on the New York Times bestseller list, has he gotten a Nobel Prize, has he gotten a PhD, how many PhDs, has he got published in certain journals? And if he hasn't, then we're not going to take the scientist seriously. But if he has, we're going to take it, everything he says, and we're just basically going to accept it unquestioningly. That produces huge self-deception. There's also a mechanism that I call morality bias, which is an interesting one. It's people who are very attached to their moral judgments and convictions. And so whenever, for example, somebody presents a truth to them, something new that they should learn or become conscious of, what they do is they compare that truth against their system of morality. And they say, well, does this truth conflict with my ability to judge and moralize about people? And if it does, that means this truth has to be false. Which is completely backwards. Because the way it should go is that you should consider the truth or the wisdom being presented to you on its own merit. And then you have to think about the consequences of that. And then you have to apply it to your existing system of morality. And then you have to say, oh, well, does that mean that now maybe I shouldn't judge rapists and I shouldn't judge Nazis and I shouldn't judge those people because I used to judge them and I thought they were evil, but now this truth that I'm being presented tells me that I can't judge them anymore. Oh no, what do I do? Do I stick with my morality or do I give it up? And see, these people, they stick with their morality because they think their morality is first and everything else comes second, which is completely backwards. And a similar sort of phenomenon involves this next self-deception mechanism, which is called, I call it political ramifications bias. Same thing, you have a political ideology, and then some truth or some wisdom is presented to you, which you have to consider on its own merit. But people don't. The way they do it is first is, rather than considering on its own merit, is that they compare it to their political ideology, and they see, is this truth or piece of information compatible with my political ideology? If it is, I'll accept it. If it's not, then it must be false, because they're using their political ideology as like the touchstone against which everything else is measured, when it has to really be the opposite. First, discover the truth, discover the highest wisdom, then ask yourself, how should that inform my political ideology? And what you'll probably be shocked to learn is that, man, it completely erodes my political ideology. And of course, most people don't like learning that. Another self-deception mechanism is historical meta-narratives. We're taught history, which gives us a context for how we think about life as a whole. Here's just one example for you, is that generally, most rationally, scientifically minded people believe the following little story or myth about human civilization. They believe that 10,000 years ago, humans basically lived like savages, like cavemen, before the advent of agriculture and before science came along, before rationality came along. We just basically lived like savages, like barbarians. We believed in all sorts of silly superstitions. But then what happened is that technology came on board, we got agriculture, and then we got the rise of Greece and Rome, and then we had the rise of reason. But then quickly that all collapsed because Christianity came to power and all this religious superstition, it sort of squelched reason for many centuries. And then we went into Middle Ages and the Dark Ages, and there humanity was floundering and nothing was really happening until the Renaissance, when the Middle Ages ended and we had a resurgence of reason, and we had the Scientific Revolution, and then we had the European Enlightenment. And so from that, we got all the way to today. And today we have science, which is taking over, and it's defeating the last remnants of religion. And now science is winning and rationality is winning. And so now finally we're free and we're going to advance ourselves to some new promised future. This is what I mean by a historical meta-narrative. It all sounds good, but is it really true? Or did you cherry-pick that evidence from history? Actually, there's a lot of evidence coming out these days, if you study history beyond what they taught you in middle school and in high school and in college, is that you actually see that this entire story starts to smell very fishy. What if it was actually the case that before the advent of agriculture, humans actually lived very consciously? They weren't savages and barbarians. They were actually conscious, and they weren't just superstitious and mythological. They actually had genuine mystical insights into the nature of reality. And they made some very profound and advanced discoveries just using their direct consciousness. Yeah, they didn't have a lot of fancy science back then. But nevertheless, they were very knowledgeable about plant life, animal life, how to manipulate stones and do stonework. And then they built some amazing monuments like the ancient pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx and these Stonehenges and other kinds of ziggurats and pyramids that are found all over the world that date back to sometimes 5,000-10,000 years ago, maybe even older. And that these people actually lived probably quite high-quality lifestyles compared to what happened later when agriculture came about. Because with the advent of agriculture, we had these cities. These cities now started going to war. Now there's famine, there's plague, there's war, there's infighting, there's egos. Now there's governments that are rising that take over. They're totalitarian governments. And all of that still basically persists to this day. And really what we've ended up doing is we've ended up domesticating ourselves. And contrary to what people think, that we're out of the Dark Ages, actually maybe we're still in the Dark Ages. It's just that these Dark Ages have become technologized. You have your smartphone, your internet, and all this sort of stuff, but you basically live in a cube. You live in a little prison. You go to work, you punch the clock, you come back home, jerk off to some porn. And what is all this? You think this is a good life? What if this is just you being an animal in a zoo? You see? So these sort of meta-narratives are tricky things. They can get you to sort of believe that, oh, everything is going peachy, but really maybe it's not. Maybe the world is on the brink of extinction with nuclear holocaust and all these other problems that we have. Who knows? I'm not saying one or the other is necessarily true. I'm just saying you got to watch out for these historical meta-narratives because they can really trick you. And this is just one example. There could be many other kinds of historical meta-narratives that you use to sort of ground your understanding of reality and to justify your behaviors or to justify society's behaviors. Another self-deception mechanism is tribalism. You probably know about this one. It's big. It's very broad. I mean, tribalism, with that comes racism is an example of that, for example. Nationalism is an example of that. All sorts of infighting, of course, partisanship and political infighting, creating various kinds of factions that fight against each other. These become huge sources of self-deception. This also happens within spiritual communities. You get various tribes that form this sort of us versus them mentalities. Another self-deception mechanism is groupthink. Groupthink is when you surrender your mind to a group of people, like in your company or in your spiritual circle or within a university or something, and then you just let them think for you without using your own mind. Because using your own mind is challenging. You got to burn calories. You got to sit there and contemplate stuff. But then what most people do is they just they just surrendered. They outsourced that. They let other people think for them. But then, of course, the problem with groupthink is that the group has its own agenda. So then not only do you have your own layer of self-deception that's you got to watch out for because it's active and running, but now you've got the groupthink and the group's ego and self-agenda, and it's also running its own separate mechanism self-deception. So those synergize to make a very bad combination. People get very deluded there. The next mechanism is assuming that everyone has the same brain chemistry and that everyone has the same basic access to reality and that reality is the same for everybody. I find this to be a very core assumption that I see almost everybody making. Almost every teacher, almost every book, almost every school you learn from. What do? They just basically assume that everyone has the same brain chemistry. But we know that's not the case. We know that we have strong introverts, we have strong extroverts. We have left-brained people, we have right-brained people. We even have, for example, sociopaths and psychopaths. We have schizophrenics. We have people who are autistic. And all of these different people have literally different brain physiology. They think about the world differently. They feel the world differently. And then you wonder why people act weird, or why they disagree with your beliefs, or why they have access to different mystical states or different consciousnesses. Well, that's because they literally do, because they have different machinery. You see? Different capabilities. Not everyone is able to learn the same things or think about the same things in the same ways. Think about how many different body types exist across human beings. You've got skinny, tall people. You've got short and stout people, muscular people, lean people, hairy people, bald people. There's a lot of variety within human physical bodies. Now imagine that that same kind of variety is also reflected on the inside. And then think about what that means for how you think about relating to other human beings. You can't relate to them as if they were identical to you. You can't expect them all to understand the same stuff you understand. You can't expect them all to have the same strengths or the same weaknesses as you have. And now all of a sudden you can open yourself up to the possibility of like, oh yeah, we need different ideas. We need a diversity in techniques. We need to be more open-minded. We need to be more tolerant of other people. But see, generally most people just assume that everyone is like me. And then they're confused when they see that, hey, if everyone's like me, then why is everybody acting so weird, so different than me? Well, maybe it's because they're not like you. Another self-deception mechanism is a preoccupation with the self-deception of other people. Watch out for this one. Sometimes people like to point out to me my own self-deceptions, as if I don't see my own self-deceptions. Here's the thing with self-deception. The most important person you got to worry about being self-deceived is yourself. Don't get too preoccupied about pointing it out to other people. It's everyone's job to take care of their own self-deceptions because you're the only person who can do it. If you are spending your time and energy pointing out my self-deceptions to me, and then I spend my time and energy pointing out my self-deceptions or your self-deceptions to you, then you see what's going on here? Neither of us is actually taking responsibility for fixing our own problem. We're just pointing fingers at each other. Wouldn't it be nicer for the person who can actually change it to be the one who is pointing it out to himself, such that every human being on earth took their finger and pointed it at themselves, and then look, the problem is fixed, because everyone's going to fix themselves, rather than pointing our fingers at others. Because if everybody points their finger at somebody else, guess what? Collectively, nobody is actually changing. It's just going to be one giant finger-pointing contest. So don't get too distracted by other people's self-deceptions. And it's tempting because you see a lot of deluded people out there in the world. I know how that feels. It's very tempting. But then actually what you should do is you should use that to remind yourself of like, oh yeah, so that means I'm probably guilty of those very same sins. So let me go inside and look for them myself rather than wasting my time arguing about other people, trying to convince other people of their deceptions. Like if you're in a relationship, don't spend so much time convincing your lover that they are self-deceived. Look for your own self-deceptions first. Besides, when you point out the self-deceptions of another to them, do they accept it and change themselves? Or do they become defensive and actually they start to confabulate and they start to justify their self-deceptions and they get even more entrenched? So it kind of has the opposite effect. The next self-deception mechanism is talking and knowing versus embodying. Have you noticed how much easier it is to talk and to know about wisdom and personal development and consciousness versus actually embodying it? Hopefully you have. It's a lot easier to talk. It's a lot easier to think about it intellectually. It's a lot harder to actually do it yourself. So watch out for this trap. Don't spend so much time talking about it with your friends or on online forums or intellectually knowing it and collecting all these pieces of information intellectually in your commonplace book. Some degree of that is important. I'm not saying you should throw out your commonplace book, but make sure that you're really putting your feet to the fire and your number one priority is the embodiment, not the talking and knowing. Another self-deception mechanism is when you think that you have the upper hand on the situation. For example, when you think that, oh, I figured the situation out and now I'm not deluded anymore. I've got the truth. I've reached the end of my journey. And just when you think that is precisely usually when there's an additional layer of self-deception that you have yet to discover. So what I often find is that when I think I have the upper hand on a situation, actually, that's usually when the situation has an upper hand on me. And that can be a very humbling experience. Watch out for that trap. And the last self-deception mechanism I'll mention is just plain old-fashioned arrogance. Arrogance is something that you just have to feel within yourself as it's happening. Notice yourself being arrogant in your speech, in your speaking, in your behaviors, in your manner, in your attitude, in your opinions, and in your ideologies. Arrogance puts you up on a sort of pedestal from which it's very easy to fall down. The truth tends to slap you real hard after you get arrogant. And I'm not immune to this at all. I know that I'm arrogant in certain ways, and I see that in myself, and that's something that I work to improve. And of course, you guys are always there to hold my feet to the fire, calling me out for being arrogant or smug or something like that. And I know that's in there, inside of me, and I felt that like since I was a teenager, I felt this sort of like intellectual arrogance in me, and I know that it's there, and I've definitely whittled it away. It used to be much worse, trust me, it used to be much worse, and I know there's still a lot more in there. But what I find is that as you're going through this process of unraveling the self-deceptions of your own mind, that you're also noticing your arrogance more, and you're letting it go, and you're realizing how much this arrogance actually holds you back from enjoying life. So that's it for this list. We're done with all the mechanisms. As you can see, there are a lot of these mechanisms, a lot of these traps to fall into. This is not merely a discussion about how to attain enlightenment. It's much more nuanced and more complex than that. Self-deception exists in many domains of life. In fact, in almost every domain of life, it exists. And I could shoot a video on every single self-deception mechanism. So that would be like over 60 videos I could shoot on all just this entire list that I gave you. And that would take me over a year to shoot all those videos. And there would be a lot to say about every single topic. So you might think that I've covered this topic ad nauseum and I've covered everything in depth, but man, there's so much more to actually be said about all this stuff. I feel like I've only skimmed the surface of it here. So I hope you can appreciate just how deep and rich this field is. And it's precisely because the field is so complex, so nuanced, and so broad that it's so deceptive. If it was just one or two self-deceptions that you have to keep in mind, that would be easy. The way that self-deception makes itself so powerful is precisely because it's so diverse, it's so broad, it infects everything. It's a total corruption of every facet of life. And so, of course, it takes time. It takes work to unravel these deceptions. And it takes nuance. Just as a warning, as I'm wrapping up here, I want to make sure that I emphasize this one final trap, which is that just because you know about self-deception, just because you heard all these mechanisms, don't trick yourself into thinking that now you've escaped them all. Yeah, knowing about them is important. You're in much better shape than had you not known about them at all. But that doesn't mean you've escaped them. Now is not the time to get cocky. Now is the time to actually get serious and say, okay, now I know them, but now I have to actually navigate every single day of my life and be mindful of all this stuff and try to avoid it. And that's something I have to keep a constant vigil about. And lastly, remember that I'm not immune to any of the stuff that I talked about. So of course, just because I'm aware of some of these mechanisms and because I talk about them, doesn't mean that I am gonna escape them all. I know that I'm deluded in certain ways. I know that I deceive myself in certain ways. I know that it's a process. And I know that I can't just drop all my self-deceptions in one day. It doesn't work that way. You kind of slowly work through them. You slowly gain emotional leverage over them. Because just because you see a mechanism working within you doesn't mean you can just drop it. A lot of times you're not ready to drop it. You might need to play it out for a year or two to see all the bad consequences that come from it. Only then will you become emotionally convinced that, okay, now I got to let it go. See? So there's no hypocrisy here. I know that I'm guilty of many of these sins myself. And so actually shooting these episodes makes me more aware of it and shows me how much more work that I got to do. And hopefully it does the same for you. All right, we're finally done. So please click the like button for me. Come check out actualize.org. This is my website. I got my forum on there. Sign up to the forum. Come look at the blog. I post new stuff there all the time. Sometimes some funny memes and stuff like that. Come check out the Life Purpose course, check out the book list, lots of interesting resources for you there that will totally change your life if you start reading those. And just stay tuned. Actually, what will be coming in the future, probably not immediately next week, but in the weeks to come, in the months to come, I'm going to shoot some deeper topics about a couple of self-deception mechanisms from this list, which are extra important. I'm going to talk about self-bias. I'm going to talk about self-justification. And I'm going to talk about the self-deceptions that are found specifically within science. All of these will be really juicy and profound topics, so make sure you stick around for those.